From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. Four women whose top secret jobs with the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II came together to tell their unique stories at Bletchley Park Presents The Real Women of Bletchley Park one Sunday in July. After the talks, podcast producer Mark Cotton caught up with Gwendolyn Page, who was a Wren in the Naval Section from 1944 and has since written books about her memories.
I volunteered at 17 for the Wrens and was called up at 18. Went to the Wrens training at Mill Hill, which is called Pembroke 3, and we learnt all the naval terms. Our corridor became the main deck, and our bedrooms were cabins, where you had your meal was the mess, and the forecastle was where you relaxed, and various things like that. So we learnt a lot of naval terms. They did ask me in an interview if I spoke German. I said very badly.
And could you speak any German?
I could speak some German, but I learnt at school, but it wasn't the suitable German for this, you see. So if I had been fluent in German, I'd probably been sent to the Y service, listening in to the German signals, as many of our people were who sent the signals to us. So I didn't know what was going to happen. They sent me to a new college for a little while. Fortnight, I think I was there, working on night watch, which I didn't like very much. Then they just told me to get into the transport next day, and I was whisked off, and I was hoping I was going to a port.
And let me guess, you got a railway warrant to Bletchley?
Well, I didn't even get a railway warrant.
Oh, dear.
I was taken by all the way by naval trucks, you know. So, yes, we arrived in Bletchley, and we were taken to Wavendon. And there was this country house with a pond there, or a lake, they call it. And I think there were about six of us, and we were shown into the garage, where there were lots and lots of bunks. And we had to sleep in the garage, where there were no windows, and we had to have the doors open in order to get air. Well, luckily, it was summer at that time. But by the time it was getting a bit cooler, they had taken over another country house, Stockgrove Park, near Leighton Buzzard, which was a modern country house and had wonderful plumbing and accoutrements. And we were then sleeping eight to a room and much more comfortable. We had no transport, and to get into Leighton Buzzard was a four-mile walk. So that kept us healthy anyway. But we went into Leighton Buzzard, but we never saw the end of a film because we had to be back in quarters at 10 o'clock. And we had to leave at 9 o'clock in order to do the four-mile walk back. But I do remember that I was very surprised, and one day, going into Leighton Buzzard, we walked through this field behind our quarters, and I saw all these fellows in grey uniforms working there. They were German prisoners of war. And I thought, good heavens, they're the enemy. They're so close to us, you know. But when I looked at them, I didn't speak to them or anything, but they looked just like ordinary young men, you know, and I felt they probably didn't want to be fighting anyway.
My mum was a land girl, and they had Italian prisoners working
yes.
near them, and she said it was the same thing. You suddenly realised that...
They were all young men.
Yeah, they're no different to our young men, you know. They're
That's
boys
it.
That she was walking out with.
Yes.
It just brought it home to you, really, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and it just shows you what politicians can do.
What work were you doing when you were at Bletchley Park?
Put on to U-boat signals. And it was indexing U-boat signals. The signals were listened into by the Y service, And then they came to Bletchley Park and they were decoded and then translated into English. So I got all the signals, and the girls I worked with got all the signals in English from the U-boats. So we knew where they were, what was happening. This was after we'd broken the U-boat code. That was what I was doing, writing these signals down on little cards, and these cards were then put in order under the U-boat number.
This is what people now have started recently calling the world's first search engine, because what you were doing was indexing information. Everything that could be known about that single U-boat right. would be on one card.
Commanders and everything. And we used to see signals too, which showed the humane side, because they would say to the commander, you have a son, you know, your son has been born, or your house has been bombed. So, you know, there were the personal signals with the German U-boats as well. But we needed to know where they were. That was the main thing. And eventually, of course, we were able to get rid of many of them. Towards the end of the war, they discovered one that had been able to get away from the destroyers with their ASDIC because it was covered in rubber. So there was no response from the metal. They finally got it by fixing mines in the sea at a certain level where the U-boats travelled. It was okay for surface craft because they were well out of the way, but the U-boats couldn't see these things and they'd go into them.
I think I'd read something about that rubberized U-boat, because that was an experimental one, wasn't it, I think?
Yes, that's right. They hadn't got around to many of them.
Yeah, they would have become that, and if it had been earlier in the war, well, I mean, in 1941, when we hadn't broken into Naval Enigma at that point, Britain was literally 6 weeks away from being starved out of the war, weren't
we? Well, they say we had just 10 days' supplies left, and luckily another convoy came in. Yes, it was very close. The difficulty with the code was the fact that the army and air force of the Germans were on three rotors and the navy
moved to
four
rotor, didn't they? Yes,
four, so it made it much more difficult.
Naval Enigma was always the most difficult of the Enigma groups to break, wasn't it? And it was the one that kept regularly being changed as well.
That's it.
Because Admiral Dönitz was worried about security of it.
But you wouldn't believe that we had broken the Enigma eventually.
But you wanted to specifically join the Wrens?
I wanted to join the Wrens because my brother was in the Merchant Navy.
But a lot of the veterans that we talked to, the service that they went into depends on a relation, and quite often a brother.
Yeah.
If a brother was in the RAF, they felt they wanted to join the WAFs. Mm. And so your brother was serving during World War II, was he?
Yes, but he was very young. He was in the Merchant Navy. And, of course, the Merchant Navy had a very bad time of it with the U-boats.
Yes,
so when I was actually put onto the U-boats section here at Bletchley Park, I was particularly interested.
Well, you had that direct connection then,
didn't
you? You had something that you were aiming for, which was to save your brother, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. I did see one signal about his ship. I recognised his ship. I think it was an armed merchant ship, the Beckingham. And I knew that he was sailing through the Mediterranean and that they were being dive-bombed by Stuka aircraft. And I just saw the Beckenham come up on this signal. And I thought, now that's what's happening to him at the moment. But of course I couldn't say anything about it at all. And it wasn't until many years after the war, when we were allowed to speak, that was over 30 years after the war, that I asked him one day, what was it like being dive-bombed through the Mediterranean? And he said, how do you know? So then I could tell him what I was doing, but up until that time, I couldn't tell him what I was doing at Bletchley Park.
That's such a lovely connection, that you kept that knowledge for 30 years and then one day, oh, right, I'm going to catch him off guard now.
Yes, well, it was more than 30 years because I couldn't speak while we were here. And we had to wait for 30 years after the war. So it was a very long time. My parents never knew what I did because they died before I could tell them.
Like many of our veterans, you didn't get a chance to tell them what you'd done, did you?
No, I didn't, not at all.
It's horrible. No. Did your brother serve all the way through the war in the Merchant Navy?
Yes, and after the war. It was his career.
Oh, was it? Oh.
Yes, and then he became, when he had a family, he became a pilot at Gravesend.
When did you get demobbed, or did you stay
well,
on?
Well, first of all, when the German war finished, I was transferred onto Japanese signals. And then I was sent to Colombo, which was Ceylon in those days, now Sri Lanka, of course, and introduced to the sub-lieutenant in the section where I was to work by the Wren officer. And I saluted him and said, yes, sir, no, sir, and all that sort of thing, you know. And as soon as the Wren officer left, he said, drop the sir, my name's Harry. And actually, we got married.
Oh, wonderful.
But we waited until the war was over and we came back home because my family didn't know him. He was a stranger.
Oh, that's lovely, that is. Yeah. Oh, there's quite a few stories of people.
A lot of people got married out there. Yeah.
I don't know what they put in the water in Colombo, but there must have been something. What specifically were you doing on Japanese codes?
It was still having them sent, you know, from the Y service and translated into English. So again, I got them in English. I didn't have to learn Japanese. My husband had to learn Japanese when he went out, but I didn't. And just a similar thing to what I was doing, but they were mostly dealing with the Marus, which are the Japanese merchant vessels. And that's the first time I'd heard of the word Maru, of course. But when some of the Allies managed to sink some of these Marus, we used to find that this name came up again, but it was in a different area, and we had to be very careful about fixing it on the right card because they used the same name of the sunken vessel and just gave it to another vessel in another area. So it was a case of being very careful where you would route your message, you know.
Yours is quite a unique story. I mean, we hear from a lot of Wrens who were bomb operators.
Yeah, the poor bomb operators really didn't know what was going through their machines at all. I knew right from the beginning because I got it in English.
And you knew they were broken codes, basically, weren't they?
Yeah,
you knew that you were working on information that had been broken from German or Japanese codes.
You guessed straight away.
Do you think there was something specific in your character or in what you'd done that made you stand out from the crowd to do that job?
I think when they interviewed us, they judged us by the character they thought. If they thought we could keep a secret, then okay, you go to Bletchley Park. But if you're going to talk too much, you wouldn't get there. I mean, that was it. They wouldn't take a chance on that.
And I think they've proven over the years that those interviews were spot on pretty much because you all did such an amazing job of keeping it secret. Yeah.
I did ask one Wren officer who was interviewing for Bletchley Park and that sort of thing. I said, well, why was I sent there? I don't know. I didn't have any special qualifications. So she said, well, we thought you were a very nice girl, so you could go to Bletchley Park.
Yeah, I don't think so many... I mean, Betty, that you shared the platform with today, Betty says the same thing. She has no idea why she was recruited. No. And there was just something about all of you that ended up here, something special about you that obviously shone out.
We didn't know what it was.
Well, no. I mean, today you've been here with three other veterans at Bletchley Park. You've all been telling a sold-out crowd what you did. You could never have imagined at 17, 18 when you joined up that you'd be doing this 70 years later, would you?
No. I mean, Bletchley Park has played a very large part in my life. Now, and thankfully, my daughters are quite happy to help me get here. And having been presented to the Queen as well, you know, that was a very special occasion. I certainly didn't expect anything like that.
You've given talks in America as well?
Yes. What happened was it was at one of the reunions here, and one of the Americans who worked at Eastcote listened to me giving a talk on the work I did. And he said, would you come over to America and give a talk to the signals people over there? So I looked at my husband and I said, dare we? Can we? He said, I don't see why not. So that's what started it. And one thing led to another and I was asked to go on five different occasions.
Are you finding there's more and more interest in what you did and as the years go on?
I am surprised now that a lot more younger people are asking me about it. I think it's because Bletchley Park's been on television such a lot. So more younger people are now asking about it. But a lot of them never heard of Bletchley Park, had no idea what it was about, of course.
I still have people talking to me now that have no idea that it's a museum and that the museum is actually open to the public. Yeah. And when they find that out, they're just, really? I can go there?
Yeah.
Yes, you can. And, you know, you can walk in the footsteps of people like you, especially in Puts 3 and 6, and actually see the conditions that you people had to work in.
Yeah, well, there have been quite a lot of people come over from America, people who were at Bletchley Park in one of the services or something, or married Americans and went over to America. And the last time we came, in last September, there was one lady of 90, wasn't she? And she had come all the way from Dallas, Texas. I mean, I think that was very brave of her. This is my daughter, and she looks after me very well.
Are you proud of your mum?
Oh, very proud. Very proud, yes. Yes, she's done a grand job, and she's kept it going nicely. Well done.
And you have, and I think I'll speak for everyone, just amazing that you're still able to help bring these stories alive, and you're still willing to bring the stories alive and tell people what you did and what happened, because this is the most important thing, I think, to a lot of our listeners especially, is to hear these first-hand accounts of what happened.
Well, that's why I wrote my books, because I got the actual Wrens who were working here to say what they did, because we didn't know what each other did. So it was a case of getting them to tell their stories in my book, so that's what I've done.
And when you say books, you actually mean books as well. You don't mean World Two, do you?
No, I have actually done 6 books, but only 3 of them are about wartime, and others are what's happened to us afterwards when we went to live in Malaya, when there was a war on there, too. Mm. And then we had a period in the South Pacific and worked there for a couple of years. So we got around.
And your husband, when you met him first in Colombo, was he in intelligence as well?
Yes. He had done the Japanese course in London, and I think they were sent out there and going to be sent into occupied territory to send back signals. Luckily, when they got out there, the admiral didn't know why they came out. And he didn't know quite what to do with them, so he put them into HMS Anderson, which was the forward base.
And luckily for you, you got to meet him.
Yes, that's right. Yes, so that was very nice. Yes, we had a very romantic time.
Did he know what you'd been doing?
He never asked me what I had done in Bletchley Park, and I didn't ask him any further about it. He just told me that he had learnt the Japanese and they were sent out there. And when they got there, the admiral didn't know what they were supposed to be doing.
So did he ever ask you, did you ever tell your husband what you'd done here?
Yes, because I wrote the books, and so he did know.
Was it a sit him down at the kitchen table and say, I've got a secret to tell you?
No. Came up bit by bit.
Gwendolyn, that's so kind of you to share your time with us for this interview, and I just want to thank you for your service. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm so glad to know that people are still interested.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.